Okay, so let's get started here. So if you go to the course webpage, you will see that I put up homework 1. Okay, so there's a homework out due a week from today. Okay, we'll try to also hand out the next programming assignment this week, just to give you a little bit of time to catch up. So the plan is the assignment will be due in about two and a half weeks. So that takes us through maybe second week of October. Okay, sometime late October we'll have an exam, as I promised or not promised, announced last time. And then there will be one more assignment after that to do in November. Okay, that's basically what is coming down for this course. So if you have any questions on the homework, let me know. But it's fairly straightforward what the questions are, and they make you review the material. Okay, as I had mentioned, we are already in chapter 6, so it is important to keep up with the class. Don't wait until there is an exam on your head to start reviewing. You'll have several hundred pages of material to look at. Okay, so just keep up with the class. Alright, so I'm going to continue our discussion on synchronization last time. So just a quick recap. So we spent some time talking about synchronization, and we motivated the need for synchronization using this problem of too much milk. Okay, so we looked at a few solutions, why they don't work, came up with a solution that does work but is not very easy to understand. So then we said, let's look at some abstractions that you can use to provide synchronization, and we looked at one such abstraction, namely lock. Okay, so I presented the too much milk problem using locks. It's very simple. As you can see, two methods for lock. You need to acquire a lock before entering a critical section, and you release the lock before you exit. Okay, and then we said, let's look into how the lock acquire and lock release work. Okay, so lock acquire allows the first thread that makes a request to enter, and then any other threads that try to enter the critical section will block. So if A goes into the critical section, B is going to block here until A actually releases the lock. So the lock allows only one thread to enter the critical section. But then the question is, how are locks themselves implemented? Okay, you need to not only understand how locks work, so you can use them in your programming assignments or other applications, but your the goal of the course is to also understand how locks are implemented. Okay. So I mentioned that there are some hardware level techniques that are used to guarantee atomic operations, and this is what locks use. So here is the first So the first implementation of locks that we will study uses the notion of disabling interrupts. Okay. So if you ask yourself the question as to why synchronization is needed in the first place, if you remember what I said, what we were looking at last time, is that it's mostly because of context switching. Let's assume that you don't do any I.O. inside a critical section. So the I.O. is going to cause you to block. But if you just have computation, then the problem is that if your time slice expires and there's a context switch, then some other thread starts executing the same piece of code, and you get into problems because of this interleaving. Okay. So first, if you had a non-preemptive scheduler, okay, you would not need synchronization so long as you don't have I/O inside a critical section. Because a non-preemptive scheduler, by definition, guarantees that you will not get preempted unless you give up the CPU. Okay, so if you are executing, and this is a uniprocessor, no one else gets to execute until you say, okay, it's fine for me to release the CPU. Okay, but most schedulers in practice are preemptive schedulers. So if you are inside a critical section, you could get preempted at any point in time. Okay, so, and then this can happen either because of internal events, which is a thread itself does some I/O and causes it to give up the CPU, or external event, namely a time slice expires. Okay. So now you want to prevent this from happening. Okay. And this, the way we are going to do this is by disabling interrupts. Okay. So what happens when you disable an interrupt is that you are temporarily telling the hardware processor, saying, even if an interrupt occurs, okay, don't take the CPU away from me. I want to execute until I am done with this critical section. Okay, temporarily you prevent any other events on the system from causing you to relinquish the CPU. And by doing so, you ensure that you can execute the entire critical section without some other thread getting control of the processor. You know, this will only work in uniprocessor, because if by definition, if you have multi-core, this will not work as is, because there will be multiple threads executing. Okay, but in a uniprocessor system, if this thread is executing, so in a uniprocessor system, if this thread is executing and you disable interrupts, then that guarantees that you will be inside a critical section without any problem. So here is how you will implement. Now, what does this have to do with locks, right? So now we'll see how the notion of disabling interrupts allows you to implement this acquire and release method in a lock. That's what we are really interested in. So this is the lock class. Okay, so there are two methods, okay, then acquire and release. Okay. So there's a value of the lock. This basically value either goes to the lock is available or not. So if it's an integer, if you start with the value 0, you assume that means the lock is free. If the value is non-zero, the lock is not free, okay, meaning it is in use. Okay, and there's a queue here, which is a queue of threads, and we'll see what this does in just a second. Initially, that queue is empty. Okay, so this is your lock acquire method. Okay, so you disable your interrupts. Okay, that's the first thing you will do is disable interrupts. So then this piece of code is going to run without the scheduler interrupting this thread. Okay, so when you do lock acquire, you disable interrupts, and then you check if the value is busy. Yeah, by busy you mean if the lock is already in use. If so, then you basically have to block until the lock is available. Otherwise, you grab the lock. Okay, and then you disable the interrupts. Okay. Is this clear what the logic is? You check with, first disable interrupts, you check the value of the lock. Is it available or not? If it's not available, you just go ahead and grab it. Okay, you set the value to busy, which means you got it, and then you disable, rather re-enable interrupts. Okay, and the lock method is just going to return if the lock is available. If it is not available, meaning it's busy, then you add the current thread to this queue, okay, and you put that thread to sleep, meaning you make the thread block. Okay, so you are waiting for the lock to become available. It's very simple logic, but there's some subtlety here. Okay, the subtlety lies with the notion of disabling and re-enabling interrupts. Okay, but is the basic logic of what the lock acquire does clear? You check whether the lock is available, if so, grab it. If not, you make the thread wait. Okay, and that's what you're doing here. Okay, now question is, why did you have to disable and enable interrupts here? What did this give us?
Why did you have to do that?
Yes, the question is why?
You need to disable interrupts so that you won't have the, you won't be able to hit if value equals busy twice.
Yes.
Say if it stopped at if value equals busy, and then the second thread started and hit that, then you won't hit that twice.
Right. So as has been pointed out, you essentially want to implement lock acquire and lock release as atomic functions. Okay? The whole function should execute and nothing else should interrupt it while it is executing. Okay, otherwise what may happen is you may actually check the value of the lock, and if this thread gets context switched out and then some other thread runs lock release, you are going to have contention problem. The same problem we had when we did the too much milk problem. But if this entire piece of code runs as one atomic statement, which means the whole thing executes as one block and nothing else interrupts it, then you are fine, and so does the lock release. Okay. Yes, question.
So the disable interrupts is a hardware call?
Yes. So disable interrupt is a way to tell the processor, saying while I am in this critical section, do not interrupt me, even if my time slice expires. So temporarily you are saying, no, if there is an I.O. interrupt or if there is any other interrupt like the CPU scheduler timer goes off saying your time slice is up, do not interrupt me, do not deschedule me. I want to execute this piece of code as an atomic unit. Okay, and then until you re-enable, all this is going to continue. Okay, is this clear? Yes, question there.
I know there's an x86 assembly language instruction that's very much like that, and it's an atomic bit flip, basically.
Yes, so we'll come to test and set. That's the other way to implement exactly what.
Didn't know how that was implemented on a multi-core processor.
Okay, so we'll come to all of that questions in just 1 second. Okay, now the release code is exactly the opposite. This is a function that you call after you have acquired a lock, you are in the critical section. So, just go back. So, this is where you would call release. So, it's assumed that you already acquired the lock and you're just trying to release it. Okay. So, again, you disable interrupts. Okay. And you check, is there some thread waiting for the lock already? Okay. If the queue is not empty, then you just hand the lock to the first thread in that queue. That's the queue that you have built up here. Okay, if there are multiple threads all blocked on wait getting the lock, just take the first thread of the queue in FIFO order and you basically give it the lock. Okay, if there is no one waiting for the lock, then it's fine to set the state of the lock to be available. Okay, so you basically set lock is equal to free. Okay, and then you re-enable the interrupts. Okay, again, this whole thing has to happen atomically, which is why you protect it with a disable and a enable interrupts. Yes.
Question. So if we acquire a lock in a thread and for some reason it doesn't release, would that hang up the other threads indefinitely?
Okay, that's a good question. So this has nothing to do with the acquiring and the interrupts, but you are just asking a question. If you acquire a lock and you never release it, what happens to the other threads that are blocked on it? Okay, this typically would mean you have a programming bug in your code. The other threads are going to be blocked forever. The system is never going to force you to release a lock. So if this thread didn't have a lock release and thread B did a lock acquire and blocked there, and this thread would hold the lock forever. Okay, so that thread will be blocked, for example. Is this clear? How do you implement a... So this is the first way that we look at how to implement locks. We are going to look at yet another mechanism. Okay, but this is the one that uses interrupt. Now, there's this notion of putting a... When the lock is in use, you put a thread on a wait queue and make it wait until the lock becomes available. Okay? But there is a subtlety here, because when you do this, we are essentially causing this thread that was running to give up the CPU. Okay, because you blocked that thread here. So if you look at this piece of code, you disabled interrupts. Let's say the lock was in use. You basically added this thread to the wait queue for this lock and you put that thread to sleep. Okay, and now the question is that thread has gone to sleep. So, but interrupts are still disabled. Okay, so when would you have re-enabled them is the question, because you don't want the interrupts to be disabled for a long period of time until the lock becomes available. So if you execute the if statement here, then the question is when would you re-enable the interrupts? Okay, yes, here's the question.
Right after the statement where it says take thread P out of the queue.
You're saying you interrupt and re-enable the interrupts here, but if you look at the code, so let's assume. So let's go back here. Okay. So your thread A, you go into lock acquire. Okay. Let's assume some other thread already holds the lock. So what happens is this thread is executing this acquire. So it will actually put itself on the ready queue, on the wait queue. Okay. And it has already disabled interrupts. So you disable the interrupts, you put yourself on the wait queue. Okay. By calling acquire, and at that point you have to relinquish the CPU because you cannot execute anymore. Okay, but interrupts are still disabled for the system as a whole, not just for this thread. Okay, disabling interrupts just disables it for the system as a whole. And as soon as you go to sleep, some other thread is going to run. Okay, and you don't want that thread to run with interrupts disabled. Okay, because that thread has nothing to do with locks. It's some arbitrary thread that the scheduler has picked to run. Okay, so in other words, you want the interrupts to basically get re-enabled if you put this thread to sleep, so, and let other threads run. Okay, and that's a subtlety. So the question is, who should do that? Right. So that's what is said into the said on this slide. You shouldn't do this before you put the thread on the wait queue. Okay, you can't say I re-enable interrupts here and I add the thread to it, because this thread is still executing. You don't want, so then this is not atomic. Okay, you don't want to do it before you sleep either. Okay, because again then this function does not become atomic, because the sleep call is made after. Okay, so in effect you want the interrupts to be disabled somewhere in the sleep call. Okay, presumably after you put the thread to sleep, then you re-enable the interrupt. Okay, now this can be done by the scheduler, or this could be done by the sleep call if the sleep call actually checks for interrupt. Okay, but it's a subtlety to keep in mind that it's not trivial, because otherwise the code will not work as you intended it to work. Okay, because you disabled interrupt and you relinquish the CPU. Okay, so effectively there's equivalent of blocking inside a critical section. This is a critical section. If you block inside a critical section, you better be sure you know what is happening. Because if the interrupts remain disabled, then things are going to go wrong in your system. Okay, your question? Okay. So that's an important problem to keep in mind. The other problem is if you have multiple processors, okay, or multiple cores, then this code needs to be re-examined. Okay, because disabling interrupts only disables interrupts on a processor, not on the multiple cores. So some other thread that's executing on some other cores may still get interrupts. Okay? So in particular, if one thread on core 1 does an acquire and another thread on core 2 does a release, its interrupts are not disabled, because this is on a per processor basis. You just prevent this thread from getting interrupted on this processor. Okay? So this thing will not work on multiprocessors as is. So you may have to generalize it. We will not talk about how to implement locks on multiprocessor here, but just keep this in mind that this solution only works on uniprocessors. Okay, so what we are going to do today is to continue that discussion, and I'm going to show another implementation of locks, this time with what is called a test and set instruction. Okay, we'll not use this notion of interrupt. That is clunky and ugly and is hard to understand. But we'll use yet another way to implement the same thing. This also requires hardware supports. And once we are done that, then I'm going to talk about the next primitive for synchronization, which will be semaphores. Okay, and then next time I'll talk about a third one called monitors. Okay, there are three of these that we mentioned. Okay. So there is yet another hardware feature that you can use to implement locks, and these are what are called atomic read modify write instructions. Okay. So what these instructions do, there are various flavors of these. This depends on the processor family, whether you are on Intel or PowerPC or some other architecture, you will have different flavors of these. Okay, but they all basically do the same thing. In a single instruction, these read, modify, write instruction, that in one instruction you can read a value from memory or from a register and write back a value. Okay, so you can do a read, you can check that value, and you can write all within a single instruction cycle. Okay, typically you would need multiple instructions. If you are doing assembly instruction, read would basically be one instruction. You can load something or you can check something. Okay, check is another instruction and write. So these three get collapsed into a single instruction. Okay, and this instruction executes atomically. Okay, this is an example of such a read, modify, write instruction. They're called test and set. Okay, most architectures support this. Okay, so test and set reads the value of a variable, okay, or from memory, and it writes one back to memory. Okay, so it reads and it gives you that value, which then you can check. And it also writes one back. Okay, so basically, if the value in memory is 0, okay, it will get flipped to 1. If it was already 1, it's going to return 1 and write 1 back. Okay. There's one called exchange, which in a single instruction swaps the value from a register to memory. Okay, this is the same thing, because it's a load and a store, okay, done in a single atomic instruction. Okay. And there's yet another flavor of this called compare and swap, which basically reads the value, okay, it compares the value with something in a register, and if the two don't match, it will swap. Okay, it will rewrite the value from R2 back to. So this is in the Motorola 6808. This is what has basically evolved to the PowerPC architecture. Okay, this is what you do on x86, and this is abstract version of this that many other architectures also support. Okay, for the purpose of this class, let's just assume that this instruction is representative of this whole family, okay, of atomic read, modify, write instructions. Okay. So here is how you would implement acquire and release using a test and set instruction. Okay, this is our lock class. There's acquire and release, okay, and there's the value of the lock. Okay, that is what we are going to flip atomically. So basically what we need to do in acquire is to check whether a lock is free, okay, and if it is free, you make it busy. Then you want to do this atomically. Okay? And the test and set instruction does precisely that in a single atomic instruction. Okay? So this is your acquire method. Okay? Just one line of code. You just do a test and set on value. Okay? You check the, what this will do is it will check the value. Okay, a value will return that value and it will set it to 1. So if it was 0, okay, test and set is going to return 0 and set the value of this variable to 1. Okay, which is exactly what you want. If it's 0, it's free. You want to flip it to busy. Okay, and you want to know that it was free. So then this while loop will not, that condition will become false and you will exit. Okay, on the other hand, if the lock is already in use, okay, then the value will be 1. So when you do test and set, this instruction will actually return 1 and it will write 1 back. So it doesn't actually change the value. So this thing doesn't look happy today. Okay. So that's all that you do in lock acquire. Okay. And in lock release, all you do is you know that the value is 1 because you acquired it, so you just set the value to 0. Okay, single instruction. Okay, is this clear? What the test and set does and how it works? Yes. Yes, we have a question.
Now, if we're going to implement scheduling within our programs, are we going to have to write this program every time, or is it in the STL already?
Okay, so typically if you have a threading library, it will support most of these primitives in there. Locks and semaphores and monitors are given to you. Okay? But since we are doing, we are trying to sort of study operating systems, we need to know how they are implemented because there is implications on how scheduling works and whatnot. So that's why we are actually going one level deeper than you. If you are just a programmer, you just need to know what is a lock and use it. You don't care how lock is implemented by your library. The library already implemented it for you. All of this hard work is done. You don't do it. Okay, but this is important for us to understand how you write operating systems and all of these mechanisms that allow applications to be written. That is the goal. That's why we are going in here to see how this works. Okay. So, a couple of things to keep in mind. Okay. There is no atomicity guaranteed in release because you are just setting a value to 0. Is that okay? So, here you did a test and set. So, that was fine. Okay. So, that was atomic. So, you know it works. What about release? No disabling interrupts, nothing yet. Does it work? Just setting a value of a variable to 0? Will you get scheduled or descheduled in the middle of doing that and cause trouble? This requires some assembly knowledge. So how assembly instructions work. What will the compiler do? This is a high level C++ Java like statement. What does this boil to in an assembly instruction? What does value equal to 0 do for you? What assembly instruction corresponds to it? Sorry?
And it?
No, it's not that complicated. How will you do an assignment in assembly instructions? Yes?
Is it just a store instruction?
Yes, it's just a store. It's very simple. I mean, this is a variable. It's stored somewhere in memory. If you want to do an assignment, you will simply store a value at that memory location. Okay, so this is just a store. Okay, so this entire function is one assembly instruction, which is a store. And we already said loads and stores are atomic. If you remember some in the previous course, not course, the previous lecture, we said that's an atomic instruction. So you don't interrupt in the middle of an instruction. Okay, so if you actually execute a store, we assume that assembly instruction is at least executed atomically. So you don't need to protect this function with anything, because there's only one assembly instruction here. That's a store. We assume store is already atomic, so there's nothing to do. Okay? That's the reason you don't have to worry about this. This will actually execute atomically without any special action on your part. Okay? This, on the other hand, actually requires some hardware support, because you're checking the value and you're setting it. Okay, if you didn't have test and set, you would have to do a load to actually load that value and check it's what it is, and then do a store. Those would be two instructions. Okay, and that won't be atomic, because you can get context switch after you do the load but before you do the store. Okay, but the test and set allows you to do both in a single operation. It's actually checking the value and writing something back. Okay, which allows you to get what you really want. Okay, is that clear? Yes, question.
With this version of the implementation, you don't get to have a queue of threads waiting for the lock to be released, is that right?
Yes. Good point. So that was my next point. And there's still something bad about this implementation. It looks very simple, okay, but it's not ideal. Okay, that's, and the answer is there is no queue, but why do we care about the queue? If this works, then why is this not good enough? Okay, it's correct. There is nothing wrong with the correctness of this. Okay, but I will say it's not efficient. Okay, why is that? What is that doing there? Yes.
It's holding up a loop.
Yes, it's doing it. It's a loop, right? A while loop. You know what a while loop is. So what will happen if the lock is busy? In use. Yes.
It'll end up using up its whole time slice even though it doesn't really need to.
Right. The lock is busy, you are going to sit in this while loop. Okay, you'll only exit this while loop and to get the lock. Okay. That's called a busy wait. Okay, and there's a statement there, if busy, do nothing. Okay, because if it is busy, just sit in the loop and just continue looping. Okay. And we said busy waits are not good things, because you're consuming CPU resources for no good reason. They're continuously checking, is the lock available, is the lock available. Yeah, it's not. So you're better off waiting rather than just sitting and checking. But it may be a while before it becomes available. You're just using CPU time. Right? So busy waits do get you what you want, but they're never efficient. It's not a correctness issue, it's an efficiency issue. Yeah, so that's what we have on the next slide. So basically, busy waiting is a problem. Okay, so what we effectively want is to check whether the lock is available. If not, just wait. Okay, that's what we did in disabling interrupt, that we actually checked the value of the lock, and if it was not available, we put the thread on a queue and made it sleep and said, when a lock becomes available, you will be woken up. Okay, more efficient. You are not using CPU time just checking whether the lock has become available or not. Yes, question.
With the release was not being atomic, if it wasn't atomic, it seems like the worst case would be that that something would think it was locked and it wasn't, then it would just have to keep waiting if it was unlocked.
If the release was not atomic, you're saying, well, there could be other problems. It depends on how you implemented it. So, but let's not go there, because this is very simple. It works. Okay, otherwise, you would have to protect it with disabling interrupts. I'll actually show you a version of release that is not atomic, because the moment you want to get rid of busy waiting, release and acquire both become more complicated. This was the simple version of acquire release. It's correct but not efficient. And now you want to get rid of busy waiting. It turns out you can't get rid of it completely. If you use test and set, you are stuck with some form of checking. Okay, that's not going to go away. Okay? But you can reduce the amount of busy waiting. So this is a lock solution with what we call minimal busy waiting. Okay, so here is, so what we are going to do is, rather than doing a test and set on the value of a lock, we will protect the lock itself with a guard. What this guard is going to do is it's going to allow only one thread to actually check the value of the lock at any given time. That's effectively what we want. We don't want multiple threads to check and change the value of the lock. We only want one thread to do it at one time. Okay, so we have this guard statement. So what happens is this guard statement prevents or allows only one thread to go beyond it at any given point in time and the others have to wait. Okay? So what has happened here? So there are two variables now. There is a guard variable and there is also the lock. There is the value of the lock itself. So you do a test and set on guard. Okay? So if the guard is available, meaning then you say, okay, let me go and check the value of the lock. So if the lock is not free, you put the thread on the queue, you sleep and you reset the guard. Okay, so someone else can check. If on the other hand, the lock was free, then you basically grab the lock and you again release the guard. Okay, and you do the opposite here. So you first go set on the guard. So if somebody is in acquire, this guard is going to cause you to wait. This is a busy wait. Okay, so we didn't get rid of the busy wait altogether. Okay, and then you go in and check, is the queue not empty? So you are trying to release, you first see is someone else waiting on the lock. If so, you basically put that thread on the ready queue and it's granted the lock. If there is no one else, no other thread waiting, then you just set the value back to free. Okay, and then you always reset the guard. So we have replaced one busy wait with another. So why is this a better solution? Okay, we didn't get rid of the busy wait. We made acquire and release more complicated. Okay, now there's more code. Okay, now it's correct. So this is not a correctness issue, but question is, just by changing one busy wait to another, why is this a more efficient solution? Thoughts, ideas. You can read the slide. I mean, most of what I'm asking is already on there.
Minimal versus inert disable or minimal versus?
Minimal versus busy wait in the previous, that busy wait. So the answer lies in what are you busy waiting on? Okay, what were you busy waiting in the first case? Okay, what are you busy waiting here for? Okay, so here you are busy waiting on the lock itself. Okay, so you don't control what the length of the critical section is. Okay, I may grab the lock and then I may execute a long critical section. Some other thread will busy wait until I have executed the whole thing. Okay, so here what are we busy waiting on? So in the first case, you are busy waiting on the lock itself. Here you are busy waiting just to check the value of the lock, not on the lock itself. Okay, so that's the difference.
So
here you are busy waiting on this piece of code effectively. Some other thread is only going to hold you up until it executes this small piece of code.
Plus it's not going to hold up all the other threads. Yeah. It's waiting.
Right. So that's why it's called minimal busy waiting. Because checking the value of the lock is much simpler or is much more efficient or a much smaller critical section than waiting on the lock itself. Okay, because a programmer may just have done an acquire, then you have this long critical section and you do a release. So here you are busy waiting until this large piece of code is being executed. Okay, you don't control this because the application programmer can use a lock to protect any arbitrary size critical section. Okay, so busy waiting on the lock will end up being a more inefficient busy wait than busy waiting on the state of checking on the state of the lock, because all you are doing is you are saying I'm going to check whether the lock is available or not, and no one else should do this while I do this, and then you check and there are only two statements here. If it's not free, you just put this thread to sleep and you are done. Okay, so this is a constrained small critical section, so this is more efficient than the previous case, which is why both of these would work, but one is more efficient than the other. Yes, question.
So, I guess you keep running acquire every once in a while to check if it's available?
you will not keep running the acquire. If you go to sleep, then the release will wake you up. You will not do that. Okay. In the previous case, you will actually be sitting in that loop all the time. Okay. So whenever you get to run on the CPU, you would keep checking. Okay. When your time slice expires, you stop checking. But at some later point in time, you will get to run again until you do this, until you grab the lock. Here, you will just sleep. Okay. And the release will actually wake you up. Because if you are waiting on that queue, eventually somebody is going to release the lock, whoever holds it, and then you get woken up. Okay, is this clear? Subtle but important difference to keep in mind. Okay, just question there.
Okay, I remember the while statement, how that's atomic, but then after we leave that statement from the lock acquire, and we go into the if value is not
equal to
3, how is that atomic
from
the rest of the code?
Okay, good point. So question is, why is this atomic? Because no one else asked the question, everyone else should know, right? Is it atomic? Does this work? This is atomic. We know test and set is atomic. But we want the whole method to be atomic, not just that statement. That was the whole point of the acquire. So why will this work?
It would work. Because basically nothing is going to execute until that bit is set, and the bit set is atomic. So there's, I mean, yes, the other threads will run, but they'll just read the lock and be like, oh, it's busy, and they'll just walk again.
Right. So see what happens in this code, right? So that's exactly right, what was just pointed out. So the reason acquire is atomic, because if some thread is inside this function, it's guaranteed that no other thread can progress beyond this statement. Because they will block here, because you have grabbed the guard and you are preventing anyone else from entering the statement. They will block on the first statement of this function. And only when you exit will one of them get to go in, the one that grabs the guard. Okay, so you have sequentialized the execution of acquire by making everyone else just spin here while one of them gets to go in. So each one has to take turns going in. So that guarantees atomicity. It doesn't matter if the thread that has held the guard is actually descheduled. Everyone else is just blocked here until you reset the guard. Okay, and you will reset it either here or here. So once you go in, it's guaranteed you are going to reset and let someone else in. Okay, same is true of release. Just by putting this guard, that's what the guard does. It prevents you from entering. That's why it's called a guard. Think of it as a guard at the door of a room. Okay, so only one person gets to enter the room. And the guard prevents anyone else from going. And that guarantees atomicity, even though there is no explicit atomicity in there. Okay? Is this clear? Okay. So that should tell you how to implement locks, which you never have to do unless you write operating system kernels or a threading library. But it's good to understand, because there are all these subtleties of how you do the acquire, how you do the release, what hardware feature will you use, and so on. Okay. Now with that background, let's move on to the next abstraction, which is semaphore. And semaphore, as you will see, is actually a generalization of a lock. Okay, it actually does more than what a lock can do. It can also behave as a lock, but it can do more. Okay. Now, what is a semaphore? Okay. Well, basically, a semaphore is an integer. Okay. But this is an integer that can be updated by two special atomic instructions. Okay. It's an integer variable, but it's a special type of an integer variable. It can only be updated using special atomic instruction. And we'll see why that allows us to guarantee synchronization. There are two types of semaphores we'll study here. Okay. One is called a binary semaphore. It's also called a mutex or a mutex semaphore. Okay. And this is exactly the same as a lock. This behaves same as a lock with a different implementation. Okay. And there's a counting semaphore, which is a generalization of a lock. Okay. So if you think of a semaphore as a synchronization primitive that grants mutually exclusive access to a resource, meaning only one thread can access that resource at any given time, which is effectively what a lock does also. Okay. What a counting semaphore does is it generalizes this, saying if you have n resources rather than one, okay, you can get mutually exclusive access to any of those n, meaning n threads can get each one of these resources, yeah, rather than just one thread. Yeah, so this is useful when there are multiple instances of a resource. Okay. And this is useful if there's only one resource, which means it's basically the same as a lock. Okay. And in this case, so as I said, it's an integer variable. So if you have binary semaphore, the integer variable can take value 0 and 1. Okay. If it's a counting semaphore, this can take a value anything from 0 to n. Okay. If there are n resources that you are protecting with this counting semaphore. Okay. So let's first look at binary semaphores. And then once you understand that, the generalization is very easy. Okay, so this is how you write, use a mutex to guard a critical section. It's same as a lock. Instead of doing lock acquire, you do semaphore wait. Okay, so you have two methods here, a wait and a signal. Okay, wait is equivalent to an acquire, and signal is equivalent to a release. Okay, so you first do a wait. Okay. Then you have the critical section, and then you do a release. Okay. And it's guaranteed that if this is a mutex, then only one thread can actually go and execute that critical section at any given time. Okay. So the two operations on this integer variables are wait and signal. Okay. And wait effectively decrements the integer, that's the semaphore, and signal will increment it, as we will see. Every time you call wait, it decrements the value of the semaphore by 1. Every time you call signal, it increments the value. Okay. So the semantics of wait and signal are as follows. So let's assume that you initialize the semaphore to 1. Okay. That makes it a binary semaphore. If you initialize it to n, that makes it a counting semaphore. So initialize it to 1. This also says that the semaphore or the resource is available. Okay. First thread comes and basically does wait, it actually grabs the lock. I mean, in this case, grabs the semaphore and decrements it. Okay, so now the value has gone to 0 and it actually gets to continue. Okay, it enters the critical section. If another thread comes and does wait, okay, then what happens is it goes again, checks the value of the semaphore. Now it is set to 0. Okay, if it is set to 0, then it must block. Okay, that's what semaphores do. Okay, it cannot so it will block, and then it cannot get into the critical section until the first thread that actually holds the semaphore goes and does a signal. Okay, when it does a signal, then it actually allows any thread that are waiting on it to enter. Okay, so signal unblocks one process from the semaphore's wait queue. Okay, and wait decrements the semaphore if the semaphore is greater than 0, and if it is 0, then it makes the thread block. Okay, so that's basically what that does, and this is the code for too much milk. Okay, as I said, lock acquire is replaced by semaphore wait, lock release is replaced by semaphore signal. Okay, and the same thing is true in thread B. Okay, so counting semaphore, rather binary semaphores, are roughly equivalent to what a lock does. And now next we are going to study how actually these are implemented. Yes, question there.
If they're basically equivalent, why have them?
Is there equivalent what?
If they're equivalent, why have them?
Okay, if they're equivalent, why have them? Because that's what the answer to that is. They are typically, you would use them as counting semaphores. But if you set the initialize the value to 1, they become equivalent to locks. But this is the real reason to have them. Okay, we haven't looked at counting semaphore. So I'm just trying to explain what the simpler version, which is the binary one, does. Then we'll look at what the counting one does. Okay, the implementation is actually identical. Okay, so this is how you would implement signal and wait. Okay, so this is the class. It has two methods. There's a wait and a signal. Okay, there's a value of the semaphore. Okay, and there is a queue of processes or threads. Okay. So you initialize it to some value. Okay? So when you initialize this class, you have to say what is the value you want to initialize the semaphore to. Typically, if it is a binary semaphore, you will initialize it to 1. Okay? It's a counting semaphore, you initialize it to n. There are special circumstances when you would actually initialize it to 0. Okay? And we'll look at that in a few slides. But let's assume value is set to 1. Okay? It makes it a binary semaphore. That's the wait process. Okay? So what it does is, as I said, it decrements the value. Okay, if the value is initially 1, it'll just decrement it and that's it. You get the semaphore, you're done. Okay, if the value is already zero, then actually that will make it negative, and then you will actually go and say this resource is not available. So you will block that process or thread. Okay, you'll add it to the queue and you'll cause it to sleep or block or something like that. Okay. Signal does the opposite, it always increments the value. And if you say the value is still less than or equal to zero, that means that the queue is not empty by definition. Okay, because only the first thread gets to go in, and everyone else will decrement the value to negative values and cause them to block. The value is less than or equal to zero, you just unblock the first process or thread on the queue. Okay, this looks very similar to a lock. Okay, I didn't put disable enable interrupts here, but you have to do that. Yes, I mean, because we know how to do that, or you know how to use guards to do the same thing. You put a guard there as the first statement, and then you do a test and set that ensures that they will be atomic. So you have to do one of the two things. Okay, either put a guard as the first statement of those two methods, or you enable or disable interrupts and then re-enable them at the end. Okay, so that part is not shown in this code, but assume that you know how to do that. So this is how the code works. Okay. So now let's try to do an example. Okay. So we will assume there are two processes, P1 and P2, or there could be two threads, doesn't matter. Okay. And we will assume in this case that the initial value is set to 2, not 1. Okay. So this is now a counting semaphore. The code is exactly the same. Okay. All you have done is when you initialize it, you initialize the value to 2. Okay. So that means that there are two processes or two threads can do a wait without blocking. Okay, if you have n, then up to n processes can do a wait, because until the value actually becomes negative, you can keep decrementing it and you will enter the critical section. Okay, and we'll see an example of why this is useful in second, but let's just understand what these sequence of statements actually does. Okay, so the P1 is doing two weights and two signals, and P1 is doing a wait and a signal, and initial value is 2, Q is empty, P1 and P2 are executing. Okay, let's assume P1 executes the first wait. Okay, what is going to happen to this value? What happens to the value when you do a wait? Decrement. Okay, so value becomes 1. Will P1 block? Okay. You block only if the value is negative. Okay, value is only 1, so there is nothing to block yet. Okay. So Q remains empty, P1 continues to execute. Okay, not blocked yet, P2 hasn't done anything yet. Okay. Now P2 comes and does a wait. What happens to the value now? It will go to 0, because every time you do a wait, you are just decrementing. It's an integer. Right? Wait will decrement. Think of wait as equivalent to decrement and signal as equivalent to increment. Okay? So this actually brings it down to 0. Okay? Does P2 have to block? Okay? No, because the value has not become negative. So Q remains empty, P1 is executing or is not yet blocked, and P2 continues to execute. Okay? Now, P1 comes and executes its next wait instruction. Okay. Value becomes -1. Okay. It's gone down to 1, 0. Here it becomes -1. Okay. Now, as you see in the code, this will cause this to block. Okay. Because what the semaphore said is, since we initialized it to 2, what this counting semaphore did, it allowed you to do two waits. Okay. And any other thread for function, rather process that does an additional wait has to block. That's effectively what has happened. So this becomes -1, Q basically P1 blocks, so P1 goes on to this queue. Okay? And the state becomes waiting and P2 is continuing to execute. Okay? P2 comes and does a signal. So what happens to the value? Okay, it will go back to 0. Signal always just increments. Yeah, whenever you have a signal, will increment the value. So this will actually go back to 0 here. Okay? And what happens to the queue? Okay, queue will become empty, because what happens is, after, since the value is still less than or equal to 0, it's 0 here, you will remove any element that's in the queue. So you will actually take P1 from the queue, so queue becomes empty, P1 gets to execute, P2 is still executing. Okay, so signal is equivalent to release. Okay, so you said I am done with the semaphore, so P2 was blocked and P2 got unblocked. That's effectively what you want. So it's anything that's waiting on the semaphore, the moment you do a signal, that gets to go. Okay, so that's done. Now P1 is again executing, so it is going to do a signal. So what will happen here? If you go back to 1, there's nothing in the queue, it stays empty. P1 executes, P2 is still executing, and then you do a signal again, value goes back to 2. Okay, and all the processes are done. So you started with 2, you ended with 2, and queue is empty. Okay, yes, question.
I don't see what you've gained.
You don't see what you've gained by this course. Okay, so I'll explain why this is interesting. Okay, so we'll get back to that. All this exercise we're doing, this is not showing you any critical section. It's just saying, what does this sequence of wait and signal do to the value of the semaphore, and whether a process gets to execute or not. So we'll come back to how you use semaphores to do synchronization. This is not doing any of that. Okay, there's another example here which I'm not going to go into. You get the basic idea. So let's not worry about it. So let's come to the problem of how do you use the semaphore to do something useful. Okay. So you know how to use the semaphore as a lock. Okay. You initialize the value to 1. Okay. And then I already showed you how to do too much wait with semaphores. This is the first use of it. Okay, here you will initialize it to 1 and you will just do too much milk or any other critical section. Okay. So you know how to use mutexes. Okay. The semaphore has an initial value of 1. You call wait before the critical section, you call signal before the critical section. This allows you to use the semaphore as a lock. Okay. That's done. Okay. Here's another use. Okay. To do some interesting scheduling. Okay. Now if you want to wait for some thread to do something, okay, you can actually use semaphores to do that. Okay. This is a case where you do not initialize it to either 1 or n, you actually initialize the value of the semaphore to 0. Okay. So what happens if you start this from 0? Here is a small snippet. Okay, this is, you declare a semaphore, you initialize its value to 0. Okay, here is a thread, that's another thread. This thread comes and does a wait. What happens? Okay, it's going to block. Is that clear? Why? If you initialize the value of the semaphore to 0 and you do a wait, then that value gets decremented. Okay, value becomes negative. What does the wait do? If the value becomes negative, it causes the thread to block. Okay, so now this thread is just blocked. Okay, there's some other thread comes along and it now does a signal. What does that do? Okay, this signal effectively wakes up this thread. Okay, why? Because this tries to increment it. Value goes back from minus 1 to 0. There's still this process is still sitting in the queue, it gets unblocked. Okay. So you can actually use this mechanism to block and unblock threads and do coordination. Okay. So in this case, so suppose this thread wants some other thread to do something, and that thread hasn't done it yet, it will just block. This other thread will come along at some later point, do whatever this thread wants, and then it will just signal this thread saying, I did what you wanted, wake up. Okay? So you can use semaphores to do scheduling of thread. You can actually use it to do what is called thread join. You can use it to implement this wait PID. If you remember in the fork function, okay, if you go back two or three classes back, I talked about fork. Okay, fork creates a child process, and then we saw a code snippet where the parent creates a child and it blocks for until the child is done. Okay, it uses the wait PID system call, which allows you to wait until your child process is done. Okay, before you exit, you could implement that using a semaphore if you wanted to. You could have the parent just do a wait, Okay, it'll block. And then the child does a signal before it's ready to exit. That'll wake up the parent. Because you can implement the same idea using semaphores. Right? Because you can use semaphores to wait and have some other threats wake you up and so on. Okay, so not only have you actually gotten the same functionality as a lock, you can also use it to cause threats to block and wake them up if that's what you want in your application. Yeah. And the third use is, as I said, this notion of counting semaphores. You can use it to protect N resources. Okay. Here is an example of arbitrary number. You know about the producer-consumer problem. We talked about that some time back. Produce, so there's a buffer. Okay. Producers are producing data items and putting it into the shared buffers, and consumers are consuming from the shared buffer. Okay. When we talked about it, then we said, we haven't done synchronization. This shared buffer needs to be protected, okay, so that you don't mess things up. Okay, now this is the full version of our producer consumers. Okay, this supports arbitrary number. You can have n consumers and m producers. Okay, any value of m and n greater than 1. Okay, and it'll still work. Okay, and this is the code. So it will use 3 semaphores to do what we want here. Okay, one semaphore is just, so we'll assume that this is a bounded buffer. Okay, the buffer, which is your array, has n elements. So producers cannot produce more than n unconsumed items. Okay, the moment you have actually filled these buffers up, any other producer has to wait until some of these slots become available. Okay, so you have this empty buffer and you keep filling this buffer. If the buffer is full, producers have to wait. Okay, consumers keep consuming. Okay, and if the buffer is empty, consumer has to wait until a producer produces something. That's the basic idea. Okay. So you have 3 of these semaphores. Okay. There's a mutex. Okay. This is basically a lock. Okay. This semaphore is acting as a lock, which is why its value is set to 1. Okay. This is a counting semaphore. Okay. Its value is set to n, okay, which is the number of items in this buffer. This is also a counting semaphore, but it also used for scheduling, which is why its value is set to 0. Okay. The way to think about this is empty tells you how many slots are free in the buffer, and full tells you how many slots are in use. Okay. And they will always add up to n, okay, because there are only n items in the n slots in the buffer. So when you begin with all n are available and there's nothing in the buffer. Okay. Is this clear, what I just said? This is a lock. These 2 semaphores are just telling you how many slots are empty, and this tells you how many slots are full. When you begin with, the buffer is completely empty, so all slots are available. Okay, and there is no slot that's in use. Okay, and that's what the producer does. This is what the consumer does. Okay, producer first increments, does a wait on empty. Okay, what does that do? That increments empty by 1. Or rather, sorry, it decrements empty by 1. The producer is producing a data item, so it has to grab 1 slot from here. Okay? So it will do a wait. Okay? So the initial value is n, so this first time you do it, it goes to n minus 1. Okay? It will not block, because it will only block when the value becomes negative. Okay? So it gets to go next. So then you grab a lock. Okay, so that's the mutex. You do wait on the mutex. If you are the first producer, okay, lock is free, so you get to go. Okay, if not, you wait. Okay, this lock is guarding your buffer. It ensures that only one thread can do something to the buffer, either put an item or take an item out. Okay, you don't want more than one thread messing with your buffer, because this is a shared data structure. So you always protect it with a lock. Okay, so any access to the buffer is always guarded by a lock. Okay, which is basically this mutex wait, that's a acquire, that's a release. Okay, so you grab the lock, add the item to the buffer, you release the lock. Okay, and then you signal on the full, saying I actually put 1 item. So full is incremented, empty is decremented. So after the first producer is done, okay, there's 1 item in the buffer, value of empty is n minus 1, which says there are n minus 1 slots more to go, and the value of full is 1, which says one of these slots is taken up. Okay, there is 1 data item in the buffer. Okay, n minus 1 empty slots. Okay, the consumer is doing the exact opposite. Okay, it will first do a wait on full. Okay, So that will decrement it, because it consumes, it always decrements. Producers will always increment full, and this will always decrement full. Okay, then you grab the lock, remove item from the buffer, release the lock, and then you signal on the empty. Okay? So now that's the code. Now it's important to understand why this works. Okay? So let's assume that n producers go one after another and fill the buffer up. Okay? So producer 1 does it, and there's, let's say, there are multiple producers, right? Producer 2 or the same producer may do it again, and then n of them go one after another. There's no consumer running yet. So what happens at the end of this? Value of empty has gone to 0. Okay? This has gone to n, okay? Because every producer is incrementing it, and the buffer is completely full at this point. All n slots are in use. Okay? So let's assume the n minus 1 producer now runs. What is going to happen? Any ideas? So what does the producer do? It basically does a wait on empty. What will that do? That will basically decrement the value of empty, because all of the slots are currently taken up. Okay, empty will go negative, because the first n minus 1, each of them decremented this, and they just ran the value down to 0. Okay, the n minus 1 does the same thing. It will make it negative, and then you have to block. That's exactly what you want. Okay, if the buffer is full, producers have to block, because there's nothing, no slot available to put your data item. Okay, you have to wait for a consumer to consume it. So the n minus 1th and for any more other producers will actually block on the first statement. They will not even get to go. Okay? So now let's say a consumer comes in. It actually goes and starts consuming. It will decrement full. Full has actually gone to n at this point. Okay, because each of the producers has actually incremented full. Okay, so they will go in. You will grab the lock. You will take the item from the buffer, will release the lock, and you will do an empty on signal. Okay? This frees up. So what happens when? So if you are blocked on wait there, and when you do a signal, you are woken up. Okay? This was precisely what we did here. Okay? If the value was 0 and you did a wait, you block, and then when somebody else does a signal, you are woken up. Okay? So here is a producer that is blocked on that wait. When the consumer does a signal saying, I just took a data item, it's fine for one producer to go ahead. Okay? It will wake that producer up, the n minus n plus 1 producer, and it will go and add the data item, and then again the buffer will be filled up. Okay? Is this clear? What happens? So you using this as a both a mechanism, so there's a lock being used here, the counting semaphore, and you're using also this to do scheduling. Okay. So basically any producer that fills, if your producers fill up your buffer, then any additional producers wait, and then you wake them up. If you are a consumer, you wake up a producer. Okay. That's what's happening here. Okay. And the reverse is also true. If the consumer runs first, before the producer has even begun, it will just come and block here. Okay. Because full is already set to 0. The first producer gets to run first, it goes and executes that wait. Okay. Full becomes negative. And it blocks there. Okay, that's what wait does for you. Okay, wait says if the semaphore is negative, then block. So if the consumer runs before any producer runs, they will all block here. And the producer actually goes, produces the data item, and then the last statement is signal. So if there is any consumer waiting, it will actually wake it up, because it just produced a data item. It's fine for the consumer to wake up and consume it. So it's basically the producers tell the consumers when it's time for them to wake up, if there is any sleeping, and the consumers tell the producers that there is a slot available. If they are blocked and the buffer is full, then the consumers can actually wake a producer up. Okay? So this is basically the general version of producers and consumers. It works with arbitrary number of threads. Okay? And all of the mechanisms we talked about. So this is why semaphores are useful. You not only use it as a lock, you also used it to schedule and also kept track of n atoms of a resource. Okay, this is why you have this counting semaphore, because it counts how many of these resources are in use. Okay, there are n of these buffers. It keeps track of how many are used and how many are available. Okay, so all of the concepts that we have studied about semaphore, they all come together in this one program. Okay, scheduling, locks, counting semaphores. So this is something to study carefully and understand how it works. This is your bounded producers and consumers using semaphores. Any questions here? Yes.
I noticed that this is on a buffer of length n. Is there a more general form that's on an arbitrary buffer?
Yeah, so you could set whatever you want. You have to start, when you start, you set the value of n. It's an arbitrary size buffer, but it's fixed. You can initialize it to any value of n, but you can't change it once you begin. That's all.
Right, I'm asking, is there any way to implement a buffer such that it could change?
So if you want an unbounded producers and consumers, okay, then this is not the right solution. In unbounded, there is no limit on this. You can have an arbitrary size buffer, then you have much simpler code because there is no limit on the buffer. Producers never have to block. So then the code is just this. The code just reduces to mutex wait, add, remove, and the consumer just does this because there is no length.
It's actually a simpler case.
It's a simpler case because you don't have to check whether the buffer is full. The buffer can be grow unbounded in size. Okay, so you just have to protect it with a lock and add or remove, and it just keeps growing. So that's a much simpler scenario. If it's bounded, then you have to actually check that whether it's full or empty. Any other questions here? Okay. So whatever I explained is actually shown in the picture here. So that's the initial value of empty is 4, full is 0. First time the producer runs, it actually decrements this, saying that it's going to take up a slot and it fills the buffer and it signals, saying there's one in use. Producer 2 has done the same thing, so there are two slots available, two in use. And when consumer runs, it actually consumes one data item, so there's only one remaining in the buffer, and it says now there are three slots empty. Okay? So this basically keeps fluctuating depending on the order in which producers and consumers are. If the buffer is full, producers have to block. If the buffer is empty, consumers have to block. Okay, but anywhere in between, they both get to run concurrently, and the value of full and empty basically fluctuates between 0 and n. Okay, so that's basically what we have for semaphores. Okay, so we talked about locks, and then we saw how to implement locks using interrupts and test and set. And I talked about semaphores, and I said it generalizes locks, and now you should see why. Because it does everything that a lock does, but a lot more. Because you can protect not one but n resources, can also implement critical section, and you can use it to do scheduling. Okay, so you have three uses here as opposed to just one for a lock. Okay, I also showed you how to implement semaphores. Okay, very similar to implementing locks. You still need hardware support, although I haven't shown it in the slides, but keep that in mind. Okay, so next time what we'll do is look at the last primitive, which is monitor. Okay, if you have used Java, you use Java threads for any particular reason, you probably have used monitor. Okay, if you use the synchronize keyword in Java, then you effectively use monitors. Okay, and we'll look at what is this concept of a monitor and how is it used. Okay, that's what we'll do next time. Okay, so let's just stop here for today. Again, a reminder for those of you who walked in late, there is a homework out. It's on the web page, it's due a week from today. Okay, so make sure you hand it in class a week from today.